I'm Brandi Cruz, and this is Politics Unpacked. Politics Unpacked is sponsored by our friends at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action. Get involved with the legislative process. Sign up for their newsletter at future42.org. Welcome to Politics Unpacked. Let's take a look at everything that happened this week during the legislative session in Olympia. I think the big thing that happened were committee hearings on a bill that has been dubbed the Initiative Killers. There are two versions of this bill, but they're essentially the same. One in the House, one in the Senate. Senate Bill 5973 and House Bill 2259. Now, it's been dubbed the Initiative Killer because opponents of the bill say it would complicate the initiative process, which is allowed for under the state constitution. And it would do that in two main ways. It would prevent people who are doing initiatives from paying signature gatherers on a per signature basis. The other thing that it would do is require people to get 1,000 signatures showing their support for their initiative before they even get to officially start the initiative process. Brian Haywood, the founder of Let's Go Washington, which is behind most of the recent initiatives, says this is really just about voter suppression.
Imagine any state, blue or red, that has complete and total control of all levers of the entire government, the legislative, the judicial, the executive branch, as well as the watchdog functions. And with that control, they then feel threatened. And we've heard already that this has been challenged in Florida, Arizona, Montana, states that are red, where the red is feeling threatened by the initiative process. And here we are in Washington State, where the one-party control is feeling threatened by this process.
Notably, Secretary of State Steve Hobbs, who's a Democrat, also testified in opposition to the bills.
The job of the Secretary of State's office is to facilitate the referendum initiative process, and for this reason, I can't support this. So this is add another layer of burden.
On the flip side of things, some union representatives showed up to testify in support of the bills, like individuals from the Washington Education Association and SEIU.
The way the initiative system in Washington State is currently set up allows millionaires and billionaires to prey on working people to achieve their own selfish ends.
Washington voters should be confident that if an initiative is on their ballot, they are being asked to consider a change in law that solves a real problem. But right now, anyone with enough money to bankroll their way through the initiative qualifying process can force statewide votes on any issue that's personal to them.
There was a really interesting moment, though, as the union officials were saying that this bill is really about trying to prevent fraud, and if you pay people per signature, then they're more motivated to forge signatures, etc.
Paying by the signature rewards speed and volume and creates pressure to cut corners. These reforms reduce documented issues such as misleading tactics and falsified signatures when compensation is tied to volume.
Republican Senator Jeff Wilson pressed them on that point.
Do you have anything to offer of specific examples, I won't use the word evidence, since 2014, that paid per signatures has resulted in a fraudulent signature as you sit here before today?
I'll take the question and say that currently I don't have it handy. I'll make sure to follow up with the committee on behalf of our testimony. Thank you.
It turns out that one of the only verifiable instances of fraud was actually allegedly committed by a member of SEIU way back in 2008 when they were collecting signatures for an income tax measure. According to an old article at the time from the Spokesman Review, the SEIU member who wasn't being paid per signature forged at least 19 signatures and was charged criminally for it. The issue of fraud is also getting a lot of attention here in Washington State after the expose in Minneapolis on fraud among the Somali population there. So independent journalists have been knocking on doors of childcare centers in Washington State and seeing some pretty concerning things. I mean, childcare centers receiving federal payments where there doesn't appear to be any children, or where neighbors say that they've never seen any children present. And Democratic leaders in Washington State have responded in a very hostile manner to even simple questions on this topic.
If you were knocking on that door and I found out about it, I would lose my mind. That is a home. That is a home where a business operates to care for toddlers.
If it's a taxpayer-subsidized daycare, we have every right to knock on the door and say, are you a legit operation?
The Department of Children, Youth, and Families audits all of them every year. Did you report that to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families?
Right.
Or did you write a story about it?
You may have the right to do that. It's not right to do that.
That hostility became even more confusing after Como News did an interview with the current state auditor, who is a Democrat, who said, actually, there are some concerning things as it pertains to federal child care payments that are being doled out by the state of Washington. The auditor says DCYF hasn't been keeping track of payment level data as they're required to do by the federal government. And so that means about $415 million worth of federal funds given to our state for child care payments are now in question. I spoke about that this week with Senator John Braun, who's the Republican leader in the state Senate. How is it possible to even do an audit of a state agency like DCYF if you don't have information like that?
I think there's two issues here, Brandy. One is some legal protections that we need to address and make it that data accessible. And then the other is a management issue at DCYF. They need to make sure they're keeping track of how they're spending money. And the taxpayers need to understand that we spend not just hundreds of millions of dollars, but billions of dollars in the Department of Children, Youth, and Families to protect young children. And there is enormous risk, not just for fraud, for misbehavior, for bad things to happen to the folks in our care. We should be, as I said, extraordinarily careful when it comes to how we, and there should be a very high standard when it comes to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. We have messed this up for too long. We need to admit that we're falling short and get after it. And the very first step is a detailed audit of everything.
On a different fraud issue, Senator Braun has a bill that's in response to a whistleblower report that we published at the end of October. In it, a whistleblower shared information on rampant self-dealing within the state's community reinvestment program. This was a $250 million fund set up to essentially help people of color make home down payments, pay off personal credit card debt, start businesses, etc. And what this whistleblower found, and there's ample evidence of it, is that some of the BIPOC nonprofits that were entrusted with these taxpayer dollars to get them out to community members have been using them on themselves to buy themselves or their family members' homes, pay off personal credit card debt of employees, etc. And so Senator Braun has introduced a bill that would prevent some of that. It's Senate Bill 6205. And it would do a couple things, but mainly it would say that if you are in charge of these funds at a nonprofit, you can't use the funds to enrich yourself. You can't use the funds to enrich a family member. And that bill actually is going to get a hearing. The Democrats have given it a hearing that will happen this coming week.
And this isn't a particularly, you know, pointy law. It simply says, if we're going to give state money to these nonprofits, let's make sure they behave reasonably with it. And that includes not, you know, dealing in self-interest. So I wouldn't characterize this as a partisan bill. This is simply a good government bill. To her credit, the chair of housing has agreed to hear the bill. So that's positive news from my perspective.
And I know that our whistleblower does plan to testify at the hearing when it happens. A bill that got a lot of attention in Washington state nationally this week was introduced by State Representative Tara Simmons, a Democrat. She introduced what she's calling the ICE Out Act of 2026, House Bill 2641. And it would prohibit all Washington state law enforcement agencies from hiring anyone who was hired as a sworn officer of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement on or after January 20th, 2025. So what Representative Simmons says is that if somebody worked as an ICE agent under President Trump, that they're not fit to be hired as a law enforcement officer in the state of Washington, even at a time when Washington state has the lowest number of police officers per capita in the entire nation. We'll see where that bill goes. There's also an ICE-related bill that's working its way through the state legislature that would prohibit law enforcement in the state of Washington from wearing masks to shield their identity. Now, they did this because they want to stop ICE agents from wearing masks to prevent being doxxed. But the reality is that even if the bill passes, our state has no control over what federal law enforcement officers do here. Still, Governor Bob Ferguson talked about it during his State of the State address.
I'm angry about this. I think many of you are as well. As an American, I never thought I would see federal agents in masks jumping out of unmarked cars and grabbing people off our streets. This conduct will undoubtedly be remembered as a shameful period in our nation's history. Senator Valdez has a bill that prohibits law enforcement from wearing masks and requires identifying information to be clearly displayed on their uniform. Let's get that legislation to my desk immediately so I can sign that into law.
Let's end with a bill that had bipartisan co-sponsors. It is Senate Bill 5071, and this has to do with updating the state's endangerment laws to include fentanyl. So there had been some criticism previously that our law around child endangerment and substance abuse in the home was outdated, that if you abused methamphetamine around a child and the child overdosed or died, the law treated you differently than if it were fentanyl. And so Republicans had really been pushing to update it so that fentanyl was in the law. And so somebody could be guilty of child endangerment if they're using fentanyl in the home and a child is exposed to it. So this passed pretty overwhelmingly in the state Senate on a bipartisan basis, although 9 Democrats still decided to vote against it. Attorney General Nick Brown came out in support of it, posting on X, "Kids in our state are at serious risk from exposure to fentanyl or synthetic opioids in the home, and we've seen harm come to children because of this. SB 5071 is a common sense approach that makes it a crime to expose a child to these dangerous drugs. Thank you to Senators Braun and Dingra for working together to update our laws to protect children and ensure accountability." And Attorney General Nick Brown alluded to it there, that the state's own data shows there's been an increase in the number of children who are overdosing and dying as a result of fentanyl exposure in the home. So while this bill didn't gain traction last year, it looks like it's on the path to passing this year. And that has been Politics Unpacked for this second week of the legislative session. We have a lot more to discuss next week on some of the tax policy that's being introduced in Olympia. So we'll see you then. Politics Unpacked is sponsored by our friends at Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Make sure you sign up for their newsletter to be alerted to opportunities to do just that and catch regular shows of Undivided Monday through Thursday. Go to undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com to sign up and support the show.